It's time to wake to sleep with Sleep Science Today, where we learn to sleep well with your host, Andrew Kolsky, on UK Health Radio.
Welcome back to another episode of Sleep Science Today. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky, and today we have Carissa Hankins. She is a family nurse practitioner, and she is going to be speaking with us about obstructive sleep apnea, but not just the regular old information. She's going to be telling us about what we can be looking for ourselves to figure out whether or not we may have OSA. And she's going to educate us more about what that actually means. So, Carissa, welcome, and thank you for joining the show.
Thank you for having me today, Andrew.
Yeah, I like this because I like to be able to give the audience the opportunity to kind of do some things on their own to know whether it's an issue or not, because, you know, people have these thoughts, or maybe I do, maybe I don't, I don't know, how do I know? I don't want to go in for a whole big expensive sleep test if it's not a problem. So this is a great type of show for the audience. I know that you have some slides with us, and I realize this is a radio show, so we're going to be very descriptive in what we're talking about, but those of you that are listening will also have the opportunity to see this on YouTube, on the Sleep Science Today YouTube channel, if you want to see what the slides look like. But so, Carissa, if you could share your screen. We'll go ahead and put that up. And Carissa has been doing this work for a long time, and she's really, really good at it, which is why I had her come and join us. So, all right, so why don't we start off with this? Why don't you just give us some of the background first of what is obstructive sleep apnea, and why do we even care about it?
For sure. So what happens when we have somebody who has obstructive sleep apnea? Like, so we all go to sleep and our muscles all relax. That is a good thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
But in obstructive sleep apnea, our throat muscles relax a little too much, or maybe a lot too much. And so no air can get in. Now, air going out, not the problem. But air getting in is the problem. And if you want to feel what it feels like to have one of these events while you're awake, I do have a little demonstration. And just if you're going to do it, just be smart about it. We don't want anybody passing out because that would not be good, right?
And don't do this while you're driving.
Right, exactly. And like, just be smart. So if you want to know what it feels like to have obstructive sleep apnea, you can go ahead and take your two fingers and pinch your nose gently. And then try to breathe in just through your nose. Just do a couple breaths, 2, 3. It doesn't feel very good, does it?
You can get lightheaded or something.
It feels pretty awful. And that is the basics, like super, super basic, super, super brief of obstructive sleep apnea, except it's happening in the throat, not the nose. And, you know, whereas we tried it for 3, 4, 5 seconds, just the space of a couple of breaths, in obstructive sleep apnea, the air not getting in lasts anywhere from 10 seconds up to 3 minutes. And and it happens over and over and over again. So it's not like, oh, we have one and then we're all set. Oh, no, 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 no. We are going to continue with that. So the oxygen is going to go down at least 3 to 4% from baseline. Now, I do want to point out that some people think, oh, my oxygen is normal, so that means I must be fine. Normal has a pretty wide range. So mm-hmm. when you're asleep, a pulse oxygen level of 89% and higher is considered normal. So you have a lot of wiggle room in that normal range,
right,
in which to have actual sleep apnea. But, you know, if you're not paying attention, you could think, I'm all set. Right.
Well,
so and go ahead.
I wanted to stop you for a second because I wanted to clarify something before we even go past this. So you said that with sleep apnea, the problem is air getting in, not air getting out, and then we did the little pinch your nose test. But what I want to clarify is it's not that your nose or your sinuses are congested, right? Like, why is there no problem with air getting out, but there's a problem with air getting in if it's in your throat and not in your nose?
So if you do have nasal congestion, then you can have a problem with air getting in from there. Mm-hmm. But that's a totally separate subject. There is a greater pressure gradient when you're breathing out. So if you have obstructive lung disease, though, then the air doesn't want to come out either. then you're going on both sides of the coin there. With obstructive sleep apnea, the air can't get in because there's not enough room in the back of the throat. Maybe mm-hmm. your jaw is very narrow. The box that your tongue lives in is very narrow, or the base of your tongue is very large, or you have giant tonsils in the back, which usually is a thing in kids, but not so much in adults. So if you have any kind of extra meat or any kind of restriction in just kind of the way you're made, there doesn't have to be a whole lot of muscle relaxation to happen in order for there to be not enough room for that air to get in.
I see. Okay, thank you. I just wanted to make sure that I was clear on exactly what that meant. So thank you.
For sure. Thank you. And I said that the breathing events last anywhere from 10 seconds up to 3 minutes. When I look at somebody's sleep test report, it's not unusual to see apneas in the 15 to 20 seconds, 45 seconds, 75 seconds. Like, they're not short things usually. And the point I want to make is that the whole body is freaking out when this is happening. Hmm. So we're totally like, ah! And so it's not a benign thing, but it can also be kind of a sneaky thing because there's a lot of signs and symptoms that go with it that sometimes, like, we're just not connecting the dots there.
I see. So when you talk about an apnea event or something, that the person is literally just not breathing?
It's not that they're not trying to breathe, because that's a different issue. They mm-hmm. are trying to breathe. And it's kind of like a workout to nowhere. So our throat's blocked off and we're using our chest muscles and our belly muscles, all our might to pull that air in. And usually we're not able to be successful until we wake up a little bit so that we can get that muscle tone back so that we can breathe. And sometimes we're flipping and flopping, changing positions. So some people, they're known to, like, they'll sit up and they'll roll over. And that's the body's way of being like, hey, wake up, you can't breathe. Or, hey, let's try this position because this other position is not really helping us out.
Got it. Thanks.
So when we're looking for sleep apnea in a clinic situation or even just a conversational situation, there's a couple of things that we look at to go, I wonder if this person has sleep apnea. And we use an acronym called STOP-BANG to screen people, and each of those letters stands for something. So STOP is snoring, tired, observed apneas, and high blood pressure. That makes up the STOP. And if you have 2 out of 4 of these, then you have an increased risk for sleep apnea. And if you have 4 out of 4, it's pretty much like, yeah, we would not be surprised if you had it. Now, right. Do you have to snore to have sleep apnea? No, actually you don't. It's not a diagnostic requirement, but enough people have the snoring and it's noticeable enough in enough people that made it into the our screening tool. Mm-hmm. Tired, because if you're waking up all night because you can't breathe right, at some point it is going to catch up with you. Observed apneas, sometimes I'll say, you know, have you seen them doing any funny breathing? Or if there's nobody there to be observing, you know, have you woken up feeling short of breath or gasping? And sometimes people are aware of this and sometimes they're not. And then high blood pressure. And there's medicated high blood pressure and there's unmedicated high blood pressure, and it doesn't really matter which one you have, because sometimes people will say, well, my blood pressure is great. Yes, but you're on like 3 medicines for it. So I don't really want to see what it looks like without the medicine, because that makes me kind of nervous.
Right.
So
let me ask just on this part, the STOP part of the STOP bang test, with the snoring and the things, well, you know, people are going to say, well, I'm asleep. So how do I know if I'm snoring? How do I know if any of these things are happening? it's easy if you have a bed partner who might say to you, hey, you're snoring or you were gasping for air. Anything that people can do to just for self-awareness?
There are a few things. I think the most interesting thing is the folks who have cats or dogs. Mm-hmm. I've done sleep medicine in clinic long enough that you start to hear stories. Stories mm-hmm. about the dog or the cat waking the person up, like putting the paw on the face, like, hey, wow. You're not okay. So, like, our pets sometimes can be a useful clue to go, hey, what's going on? The other thing is, a lot of people, if they sleep alone, like you said, how are they going to know? So mm-hmm. some folks, their impetus for getting evaluated for sleep apnea is they went away on a trip, shared a hotel room with someone, and it was like, dude, you better get that checked out because I cannot sleep because your snoring is so awful. There are certainly other things that we look for. And so moving on our risk stuff, we have, we'll look at the BANG piece of the acronym. So BMI is the B in BANG. So if we have more weight on us, then we have an increased risk for sleep apnea. Mm-hmm. BMI over 35. But that doesn't mean if you are under 35 on your BMI that you're all set. If you have a pulse and an airway, you still have risk, right?
Right.
A in BANG is for age, so age over 50. And really in men, I start increasing their, like, my awareness of their risk at the age of 40 and not 50. Mm-hmm. Neck size, and we're looking just under at the top of the neck, not at the collar line. So neck size in guys, over 17 inches is a risk factor. And in ladies, over 16 inches is a risk factor. And the reason is the larger the neck on the outside, the smaller it is on the inside. And then the last piece of BANG is gender, and so that's men more than ladies. However, us ladies, we catch up after menopause. So we take a little bit longer to show the symptoms and to fully bloom into that diagnosis. We are not exempt. We just, once we have menopause on board, then we have our own special set of risk factors.
So, you know, that's a great place that I'd love to ask you another question, because this comes up often with people that I speak to. And that is, you know, when we hear about obstructive sleep apnea, the typical picture that probably comes to many people's minds would be a male somewhere around 50 years old, probably overweight, like you said, a bigger neck, snoring, all those things. But then I have many women who, in the most part, I guess you would say would be postmenopausal, but they're not overweight. They don't have any of the signs that one might think of to think about sleep apnea. Yet, when they go in for a sleep test, a polysomnography, they end up having sleep apnea. What's going on there? Can you talk just a little bit more about that?
So sleep apnea comes in, I like to call it, different flavors. We have our folks who are the typical overweight, extra tired, snore like a bear, larger folks. You know, if you catch them in a boring place like church or a waiting room or a conference, they're the ones like with the head bobbing, like just trying to hold it together and stay awake. But then we have several other what we call phenotypes or endotypes of sleep apnea. And the postmenopausal woman is one of those because she doesn't have to have a lot of extra weight on her. We also have the folks with a very narrow jaw or soft palate. And that's the way they're made. And weight has absolutely nothing to do with it.
Wow.
Weight has absolutely nothing to do with it.
Sorry, I was going to say, this is a great spot for us to stop for a commercial break, because we've got to get those in here. So if you'll bear with us, we'll come back and continue our discussion with Carissa Henkins. We'll be back in just a minute.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
If optimizing your health and well-being is on your to-do list, Then let Revive Active, Ireland's number one supplement brand, help you put back what life takes out. All-in-one comprehensive formulas created to offer you maximum benefit, whatever stage of life you're at, and with a range that supports everything from immunity, energy, cardiovascular health, joints, cognitive function, menopause, and even beauty. We've got you and your family covered. Premium ingredients packed into a powerful daily sachet. Simply mix with water to activate for a flavorful health drink. Perfect at home or on the go. Revive Active. Available at selected Holland & Barrett stores, Well Pharmacies, and online at Amazon and reviveactive.com. Super supplements for a super you.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens, and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Okay, Andrew Kolsky here with Sleep Science Today. We're speaking with Carissa Hankins about obstructive sleep apnea. We were just talking about the difference between women and men. So, Carissa, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Andrew. One question I get a lot is, how do I know that I could have sleep apnea? And a lot of times people think that maybe perhaps me as a clinician that I might be stalking them, because I'll start saying like, hey, well, what about this and what about that? And they go, whoa, how did you know that? So when we think about it, when we are the way we are made, our brain and our heart, those are the two hungriest organs that we own, right? Mm-hmm. So they get first dibs on the blood coming out of the heart. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the symptoms that we see with untreated obstructive sleep apnea are related to that particular way that we are made. So sometimes people have leg cramps overnight, waking them up, and they'll think, oh, well, I'm just dehydrated or I had a long day. Well, you know what? If your oxygen is tanking, whether it's from sleep apnea or some other reason for your oxygen to go down, like, it would make sense that your muscles and your legs would be very angry with you, because your body's prioritizing your brain and your heart over your legs, which are the farthest away from your heart. Mm-hmm. Then we get into nightmares. So imagine, you're like, your throat's blocked off, your whole body is just panicked trying to get this air in. Well, when you get into REM sleep or dream sleep, what kind of a story do you think your brain is going to pick to go with those physical feelings? It's not going to be like muffins and sunshine and fresh coffee. It's going to be horrible stuff.
Right. No puppies or kittens.
Yeah, no, nothing fuzzy. It's usually pretty awful things. And so your brain's going to go in its memory banks and pull up like the most horrible things to go with those feelings from the untreated sleep apnea. And while it doesn't apply to everyone, like, there's a lot of times we get somebody's breathing problem treated, the nightmares go away. And their dreams change. Either they went from dreaming all the time or to none of the time, or they went from really horrible dreams to like just weird dreams. Mm-hmm. And I did want to take a little aside. When we get into REM sleep, the part of our brain where our social filter lives, it's called the prefrontal cortex. Well, mm-hmm. that's where the social filter lives, and that gets turned off in REM sleep. So if you're like, man, I dream this really crazy weirdo stuff, it's because your social filter is not there to say, hey, that's a bad idea. So it's supposed to be a safe place. And I get a lot of questions on that, like, why are my dreams so wackadoodle? Yeah, well, social filter's taking a nap. She'll be back. It's fine. Then we have frequent bathroom breaks. So again, body's freaking out. Heart's like, oh my gosh, ah, I can't do it. The heart ends up going into sort of a mini temporary heart failure. It can't keep up because it's not getting the oxygen it needs to do its job. And the kidneys will hear this and go, oh, we can help. Oh my goodness, let us help you. So what the kidneys do what they do best. They make urine. So they're going to divert some of the blood supply, some of the fluid part of the blood. They're not going to send it back to the heart because the heart's already like, I have too much work to do. I can't. They're going to turn it into urine, which then equates to you having to get up every 1.5, 2 hours, 3 hours overnight. And you're like, where is all the pee coming from? I stopped drinking at, I don't know, 5 p.m. and I'm still peeing all night long. It could be because you're not breathing right. Brain fog is a thing because, you know, it's sleep or breathe. We can't do both well at the same time. And some of those stages of sleep, we need them to be able to think like we're supposed to. And then daytime shortness of breath. People don't often think like, oh, sleep apnea is a 24-hour health problem. They think of it as a sleep problem. Well, it doesn't have to be a sleep problem. When your oxygen goes down, the blood vessels in your lungs, they tighten up. And that makes it a lot harder for the heart to get the blood through your lungs and then into the other side of the heart and onto the rest of your body. And the shortness of breath that goes with that, sure, it can be helped by, you know, when you're awake and you're breathing properly. But if we can maintain you breathing properly and prevent the oxygen from going down, then a lot of people will say, you know what? I am not as short of breath as I have been. This is pretty awesome. Now, this is not the complete list of symptoms by any means, but these are some of the big ones that people don't often put two and two together on. And some people, you know, if it's like, dude, if I could drop like 2 bathroom breaks, I would be solid, right? Or if I could get rid of those nightmares or leg cramps, like sign me up for that.
Well, let me ask sort of the devil's advocate question here. So you have a client and they may have obstructive sleep apnea and they say, well, you know, look, I hear that the treatments, and I realize we're going to talk about treatments in a little bit, but they say, I hear treatments are like that big machine or mask I got to put over my face. And if you're telling me that the problems are leg cramps and nightmares and frequent bathroom breaks and things like that, you know, maybe I could deal with those. It seems like that would be more comfortable than having to deal with the treatment. So my question to you is, even if a person were willing to put up with those things, are there other health issues that are more, you know, that they really should not be trying to ignore?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We know that untreated sleep apnea increases the risk for dementia and heart attack, stroke, blood clots, atrial fibrillation, which is the top of the heart, it quivers instead of giving a good beat. And so those are longer term things. Those are things that you don't want to have to go through if you can help it. And for some people, like, that is their motivation, is I don't want to have AFib, or their cardiologist sent them, right? And their cardiologist is like, we can do a surgical procedure to help with your AFib, but you have to have the sleep apnea treated first, right? So some people, their weight gain or their excess amount of weight that they're holding is because their sleep apnea is untreated. Now, I never promise anybody that you treat your sleep apnea, you're just magically going to lose a bunch of weight. Some people have managed to do that. But there's a hormonal component that goes into the weight gain, and being in this stressed out body freak out sort of a situation all night long, every night, like, that's not helping with that longer term goal. So I think everyone who's facing like, do I have sleep apnea? Should I be looking at doing something about it? You need to understand or try and figure out what your why is. Like, why would I do this? Is it because right now I'm miserable? Or is it because later I don't want to be miserable? Or is it both? Because a lot of times it is both.
Right. Well, it's really interesting that, you know, just generally in the news, I've noticed a lot more stories and interests about dementia and things that people can do to help, you know, prevent or stave that off longer. And I think, as you said, this is one of those important areas that sleep, and especially if you have sleep apnea, treating it is going to be one of those things that can potentially help, you know, avoid or lengthen the time before it occurs. But, you know, there's a lot of things that we can do to help ourselves from that dementia angle, and sleep is certainly an important one, especially treating sleep apnea.
For sure. For sure. All right. So when I'm looking, when I have someone in a clinic situation and I'm going, I wonder if they have sleep apnea, aside from asking our stop bang sorts of questions, I also will look at their face because there are clues to the presence of sleep apnea potentially that live on our faces. The first one is something called ptosis. It's a P-T-O-S-I-S, ptosis. And that's saggy eyelids. There is a condition called floppy eyelid syndrome, and 90% of people who have floppy eyelid syndrome also have sleep apnea. So it's one of those things where you're like, you have saggy eyelids. I wonder if your airway is sagging as well. And when you know to look for the saggy eyelid thing, even if it's not like so bad that the person can't see because their eyelids are so droopy, even if it's just kind of on the edges that they're kind of sagging, that can be enough to go, I wonder if you have sleep apnea, because you could. Mm-hmm. The next clue that lives on our faces is something called rhinophyma, and that is an enlarged, bulbous, red, possibly red, end of your nose. Now, some people think, you have to be a big drinker to have rhinophyma. And yes, it does go with alcoholism, and it also is a version of rosacea. But both of those things are also connected back to obstructive sleep apnea. So not everybody who has the large bulbous nose of rhinophyma is going to be a big drinker, although, you know, some folks are going to be. And then the last thing to look for when we're just looking at someone's face is their jaw small? Is their jaw seated backwards? So retrognathia would be the seated backwards jaw, and micrognathia would be a small jaw. So I want to say Down syndrome is one that will have that smaller jaw set up, because the box that the tongue lives in, it's going to be smaller, so then we're not going to have too much room for the tongue to relax before our airway starts blocking off. Now if we want to get even closer, we just say and so we would look at someone's mouth. If you open your mouth and say how much can we see? Can we see the whole way back? Or is it that all we can see is tongue? And that would be the Mollen-Potty score. So Mollen-Potty of 1, you can see the whole way back. You can see the uvula. Mollen-Potty 2, you can see most of the stuff back there. Maybe not the tip of the uvula, but pretty much everything else. Now Mollen-Potty 3 and 4, the 3s, you can barely see the uvula soft palate. And the 4, it's pretty much like all I can see is tongue. So if you're a 3 or a 4, then that tells us that the box your tongue lives in, or how large your tongue is, it's on the large side and your airway is likely getting crowded. The other clue is if you look in the mirror and you look at the sides of your tongue, do you have little wrinkles on the sides of your tongue? These are called crenations. Crenations is the medical term for wrinkly. And that's where your tongue is actually filling in the spaces between your teeth because it doesn't have enough room. So those are some of the risk factors that we look at when we're getting close to folks. I'm going, what's your risk here? What is your risk here? Now, if you want to try to figure it out yourself, I instruct people on how to do a selfie assessment. So you need either a cell phone, or you can do it in the mirror with a flashlight. If you're going to do it with a cell phone, you would take 3 selfies. You would do one face forward, one with your mouth closed, one with face forward with your mouth open, and then one on the side view, so you get your profile view. And the challenge is to go, do I see the eyelid droop? Do I have the rhinophyma? Is my jaw sitting backwards? And you can also do, you know, how large does my neck look? And so in that way, you can start to assess yourself and go, so maybe I'm not making this up. Maybe I do need to have that conversation with my healthcare team.
So question for you here as we're looking at this part of it. You were talking about looking inside of your mouth and seeing whether you can just see tongue or whether you can see a clear pathway and the uvula and all that. Is that with them just opening their mouth, or are they sticking their tongue out? Like, what are they doing when they're looking?
I would say don't cheat when you do it. So yes, tongue out. But like, don't be pushing your tongue down in the back. Cause I know like when I've done it often enough where I'm like, oh yeah, I can just pull it down back there. No, we want it kind of in the most relaxed position possible. Mm-hmm. So that we are doing a good assessment. And quite frankly, when I examine people in my role as a nurse practitioner, the folks I'm examining, they don't know to pull their tongue down. They just say, ah, and I look and go, oh, yep, okay, we're all set. Right. So, yeah.
Okay. So for those of you who are listening on the radio, if you go to the YouTube channel, Sleep Science Today, you can see the slides where Carissa has some pictures of what she's describing. It just kind of helps to understand what we're getting into. So we're at a point where we need to take another commercial break, and then we'll come back and we'll continue our conversation. So bear with us. We're on Sleep Science Today. We'll be back in just a minute.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Stop suffering with pet-related allergies when near dogs and cats. Great news, you can feel safe around pets with Nasal Guard for pet lovers. Nasal Guard topical gel blocks pet dander, hair, and dust mites from entering your nasal passages. Try Nasal Guard for pet lovers today. Visit Amazon or nasalguard.co.uk to learn more about Nasal Guard spray and gel products. Again, that's nasalguard.co.uk.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com.
Strawberries and cream. A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
Okay. Back on Sleep Science Today. This is your host, Andrew Kolsky. We're with Carissa Hankins. We're talking obstructive sleep apnea. We were talking about some ways that you might be able to self-diagnose, and I don't mean full official diagnosis. I mean get an idea of whether you might have sleep apnea. So I'm turning it back to Carissa.
All right. So the next thing I wanted to talk about was how we classify sleep apnea, because there's a little sneaky thing that kind of goes on just on the basis of statistics. So if you go for a sleep test, you're going to come out of your sleep test with an AHI or apnea hypopnea index. That's the number of times per hour of sleep or testing, if it didn't measure sleep, that you were not breathing like you should have been. Now, less than 5 is considered normal. 5 to 15 is mild sleep apnea, 15 to 30 is moderate sleep apnea, and above 30 is severe sleep apnea. And yes, I have joked with my patients, like, oh, you're double severe because your sleep apnea number is 60. So it's not a real thing, but it does get the point across as far as, like, this is a big problem. Mm-hmm. One of the issues with AHI is that it's a measure of severity based on frequency, not based on how long the breathing events last and not based on how severe the oxygen drops are. So let me explain. My worst apnea in one of my patients lasted over 2 minutes and 15 seconds.
Mm,
yes.
Wow.
The sleep tech was like having a panic attack, and he did get invited to come the next night, and we got his breathing fixed. He did great. But 2 minutes and 15 seconds. Now, with our AHI, the way it's set up, it's number of times per hour of sleep. That breathing event, as robust as it was, it still only counts as one. And I mention that because a lot of people, they're out there going, oh, well, you know, my sleep apnea number is 5 or 7, and it's mild. Is it really mild? Are you just going by that number? Or, you know, did you look at what the oxygen is doing or how long those breathing events are? Because I think a lot of times we don't look at that data when we're talking with people. And I'm talking, our healthcare teams aren't necessarily looking at that data, and our patients aren't necessarily looking at that data. So there's a lot of folks out there who are like, oh yeah, I'm all set, it's mild. Well, mild is still severe enough to cause problems for people. Especially depending on the person.
Mm-hmm. Right.
All right. So if there was one thing that I want to impart to our listeners and your viewers about sleep apnea, it's that sleep apnea does not present always in the ways that we would expect. Now, sure, a fair number of people, they snore and they have sleep problems and weight problems, but there's also a fair number of them who don't, but they still have sleep apnea. And sometimes the healthcare team is blowing them off, or sometimes they're blowing themselves off, like, oh, it's fine. You know, it's just menopause, or I'm just out of shape, or it's medication side effects, or, you know, whatever the case may be. Mm-hmm. And I've worked in sleep medicine actively as a nurse practitioner in a sleep clinic for 9 years. And then I did 3 years in pulmonology. And all I did was spend my time helping people with sleep apnea. And so how ironic is it that there's a case of undiagnosed sleep apnea sleeping next to me for years and I didn't see it? And it wasn't because I wasn't looking for it. I was absolutely looking for it. But it's because sleep apnea doesn't always present how you'd expect.
Wow.
Now, there are three types of people with sleep apnea. You can be in all these categories at one time. We got the folks who can't sleep, the folks who can't sleep enough, and then the people who are like, I sleep just fine. I don't have a sleep problem. Yes, you probably don't have a problem with sleeping. It's the breathing that's causing you some other problems. So if you are somebody who you can't sleep, you may not realize that it's because you aren't breathing that you keep waking up. And if you're somebody who can't sleep enough, you may not realize that your sleep is so fragmented and interrupted that your brain is hungry for sleep. So you do anything semi-boring, breathing upright, your brain's going to be like, let's do it. Let's do it. 15 seconds, 30 seconds, we need this sleep. So that's how people can end up having motor vehicle accidents, because even though they feel like they are a safe driver, like when the sleep pressure gets high enough, the brain is going to just overpower someone and go, oh, finally we can get some sleep.
Yeah.
That is also to say, and that's not to say that, you know, everybody with sleep apnea is a hazard on the road. Certainly not. But the other thing is, if you have untreated sleep apnea, even if you're like, I don't have a sleep problem, I sleep just fine. If you're going to have some sort of a catastrophic medical event, like a heart attack or a stroke or something of that nature behind the wheel, it's not going to wait until you pull over to happen, right?
Right.
So I've had bus drivers, I've had truck drivers who were very upset at getting referred to sleep medicine. You think I'm an unsafe driver? No, I don't. Actually, I really don't. But there are some things we cannot control, like when you might have a catastrophic medical event. And so having things in place to reduce the likelihood of that happening, that's safe for you, that's safe for your employer, and that's safe for everyone else who is sharing the road with you.
Right. Right. Wow. So, okay, so we've talked about what it is, we've talked about how we might do a self-assessment, we've talked about the dangers of not treating our sleep apnea, so we've got about shy of 5 minutes to talk about how do we fix it.
I love this question. There's a lot of different ways to fix sleep apnea, but before we even get to that, there's two keys to successful treatment for sleep apnea, whichever option someone chooses. Number one is motivation. Why am I doing this? Why should I do this? What is going to make this worthwhile to me? Figure that out, and you're like 50% of the way there. The other piece is the details. And if the details are not right, then this is not going to be a sustainable therapy, whichever one it is. And if it's not sustainable, then it's not going to be successful. Now, the most common treatment for sleep apnea is something called CPAP therapy, and that's where we use air and in the throat to hold it open. Mm-hmm. It does use a mask. It does use a machine. And for some people, the thought of having to sleep with a mask just sounds horrible. And what I'll tell people is that if you're going to do the CPAP thing or the mask thing, it's kind of like trying on dress shoes. You don't know until you try it on, number one. Number two, some things just look horrible, right? And you don't know until you try them. So, like, if you've ever, now I'm sure, Andrew, that you have not had the experience of wearing high-heeled shoes.
I have not.
But, like, I look at a pair of high-heeled shoes and I'm like, that looks like freaking torture. and a lot of people feel the exact same way when it comes to CPAP. That looks like torture. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be torture, but there's a lot that goes into it. Like, getting tested, that is a battle of one night, right? Mm-hmm. Treating the sleep apnea is the war that happens every single night after that.
Right.
So CPAP is supposed to be put it on, go to bed, done. There's a lot of work that goes into getting to that point, which boils down again to motivation and details. But it needs to speak for itself, because if it doesn't speak for itself, then it's not going to be sustainable. Why am I doing this? Why am I torturing myself? If you know, and if every night is going to be like this night, then I'm not interested. So it does not have to be that way. There are other treatment options out there. There's oral appliance therapy. There is the Inspire device. That's the implanted nerve stimulator. But there's some other lesser known ones. One is called INAP, or intermittent negative airway pressure therapy, and that's a small suction device that pulls the tongue forward, super quiet. There's another one called Excite OSA. That's a electrical, it's a stimulator for the mouth that you use during the day, and it's supposed to beef up the tongue muscles, so when they relax, they don't relax so much that they're blocking off the throat and the airway. And each of these treatment options has a very narrow or very specific population who they're indicated for. So the person who's a candidate for Excite is not necessarily going to be somebody who would do the Inspire device. Weight loss can also be a treatment option for some people, but it needs to be an add-on option usually, because without having something else to interrupt the hormonal piece of the sleep apnea that can drive up the weight, the progress can be very slow and very, very frustrating.
Right. Wow. So, you know, it's great that there's a lot of different treatment options out there, because you know, I know you hear it, and I know I hear it from a lot of people, this fear of having to wear this mask or trying to wear it and saying it's so uncomfortable, I can't deal with it. So in our last minute here, you know, I've also found that when people start wearing the mask and they give themselves a chance to get used to it, then all of that kind of goes away and it becomes pretty easy for some people. Any comments or advice on what people might be able to do there in our last 30 seconds or so?
Sure. There are a lot of people who have figured out the magical formula to successful treatment with their sleep apnea. And if you can hook in with a couple of those people and borrow from their experience, like that can take you a long way for sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that can take you a long way. And also just communicating with your healthcare team, because they don't know that it's not working. They don't know that it's awful. And I guess the last thing is to be persistent. So, you know, it's still awful. Help me out here. I cannot continue to do this. So those will be the things for sure.
Okay. And I know that you actually offer coaching to work with people to help them become more comfortable with this so that they can do the treatment necessary and avoid all those bad things that could happen.
Right. And the biggest thing is, like, you don't have to feel alone. So if you don't have people or you want a pro, that's why I'm here. That's what I do with my clinic, Hello Sleep Health.
Fantastic. Well, Chris, I want to thank you for taking the time out of your day to join us and share all this information. I know it's really helpful for people when they can, you know, learn about some things they can do on their own to get a better sense of what might be going on. I do want to stress that if you do have sleep apnea, it's really important to treat it. You shouldn't just ignore it because it can have all of the negative issues that we talked about. I want to thank you all for joining us on another episode of Sleep Science Today. Please visit our website, sleepsciencetoday.com, where you can sign up for a free ebook and also special offers and special opportunities that only you will receive by being on the mailing list. And if you want to see the slides and things that we talked about during this particular session, join us on YouTube at Sleep Science Today, and you can watch all the slides. So thank you. We look forward to seeing you on our next episode.
Thank you for listening to Sleep Science Today and learning how to sleep better with your host, Andrew Kolsky, on UK Health Radio. For more information on how you can achieve better sleep, go to sleepsciencetoday.com. Remember, Sleep Science Today and sleep better tonight.